Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thank you for having me here tonight. It is such a pleasure to be able to present my work, my book manuscript in progress, to this audience and hopefully get some feedback and criticism that will make it a better manuscript. My current book manuscript is titled Cybernetic Socialism, and it is on the history of Project CyberSyn. Project CyberSyn was a computer system that was developed by the socialist government of Salvador Allende to help regulate the nationalized sector of the economy. From 1971 to 1973, a team of Chilean and British scientists and engineers created a system that collected production data daily and gave the government a bird's eye view of the Chilean economy, which was something that they didn't have before. Project CyberSyn is interesting for a number of reasons, not the least of which is this rather striking photo of the operations room that was built for Project CyberSyn. And this room was inaugurated at the end of December 1972. Okay. So it's hard to squeeze a multi-year book project into a 20 to 30 minute talk, so I figured that I had two options. I could either go into one chapter in depth, or I could give you a high-level overview of the book manuscript and introduce some of the source materials and themes that I used to tell this history. So I opted for the latter, but as a disclaimer, bear in mind, this is a much simpler story, what you're gonna hear right now, than what the story actually is. So I'm gonna begin by giving you an overview of the CyberSyn project. I'm then going to share some of the themes that I addressed in the manuscript, as well as some of the source materials. And you're going to see a range of source materials on my slides. But in addition to these source materials, I've also collected over 50 oral history interviews on three different continents with different participants in this project that range from factory workers to high-ranking members of the Chilean government. And then finally, I'm going to share some of my thoughts on the significance of this research. So, just so we have our geographical bearings, this is Chile. It is a slender sliver of the Latin American continent that is bordered by the Pacific Ocean on one side and the Andean Cordillera on the other. And CyberSyn began during a really unique moment in Chilean history. And I'm referring to the brief presidency of Salvador Allende, who won the presidential election in 1970 by a slim 1.3% margin of the popular vote. Allende ranks as one of the more controversial figures in Latin American history, not only because he was the country's first democratically elected socialist leader, but because he also advocated for a peaceful road to socialist transformation that was built upon Chile's existing democratic practices. So, for example, his platform for socialist change included respect for the existing constitution, it included freedom of speech, it included freedom of the press, and it included free elections. Some critics have lumped Allende with Fidel Castro, but in reality, his outward political dream was a peaceful road to socialist change, a revolution with empanadas and red wine, a revolution without costs. Now, the Chilean Revolution took place on many fronts. Although Allende insisted that he would control the revolution from above with a firm guiding hand, in reality, workers took control of their factories and peasants seized land from wealthy landowners. The revolution also took place in Chilean laboratories, drawing boards, and in production lines. It transformed the way that scientific research was conducted, as well as the scope of national engineering and economic projects. So for example, I think this is a particularly beautiful image. This is of a record player that was built by Chile's first state-funded industrial design group. And this industrial design group was formed during the Allende government, and the idea was to take a good that previously had only been available to the wealthy elite and make it available to the masses. And this record player was designed by the same group that did the operations room that I showed you a few slides back. So Allende made nationalization of Chile's major industries one of his priorities. And in his first year of government, he made significant strides toward this end. To give you an idea, by the end of 1971, the government had transferred all major mining firms and 68 other industries from the private to the public sector. And by the end of 1972, about 25% of all industrial production had fallen under control of the state. And in the larger book manuscript, I detail this process, which was tremendously fraught, and the political negotiations that it involved, because it presented a substantial challenge to the Allende government. But these political considerations aside, from a strictly management perspective, this was a management nightmare. Think about the number of industries that were coming under state control very quickly, and also that these industries continued to hire more and more people because they were state-run. So it was a tremendous management challenge. And the Allende government had given the State Development Corporation the responsibility for handling this process, but they were dreadfully underprepared for this. So the person who was the general technical manager of Corfo in this moment, which was the upper management position most directly related to the daily management of the factories, was a man named Fernando Flores. And that name may be familiar to some of you for the work that he's done in recent years. And this is a picture of Fernando Flores from the early 1970s. And Fernando Flores had a very unorthodox idea of how he might solve this management problem. So in the 1960s, Fernando Flores was studying at the Catholic University in Chile. And he happened to learn about a British cybernetician named Stafford Beer. Stafford Beer had become the director of cybernetics and operations research for United Steel, which was the largest steel company in Europe. And then he worked for a consulting company, Science and General Management, or Sigma. And Sigma had a contract with the Chilean railways. And in order to complete the contract, they hired a bunch of Chilean students. And among them was Fernando Flores. So Flores started learning about cybernetics during the 1960s, and he started reading Beer's work afterwards. So when he came to this position within Corfo, he thought that he would contact Stafford Beer. And this is a copy of the actual letter that Flores sent Beer, and it's dated July 1971. And Beer's response was most enthusiastic. You can read it right here, because this is a copy of the letter he sent back. He said, "Believe me, I would surrender any of the retainer contracts I now have for the chance of working on this. That is because I believe your country is really going to do it." And think of it from the perspective of Stafford Beer. You've been dedicating your life to management cybernetics, and someone offers you a country, you know, to basically implement your ideas. I mean, that doesn't come along every day. So this is what Stafford Beer looked like in the early 1970s when he first arrived in Chile. And this is a picture of Stafford Beer in 2001. And I feel extremely fortunate because I was able to conduct 2 days of interviews with Stafford Beer, probably about 8 hours each day. So there were these very rich and in-depth interviews. And he told me that he hadn't shared this level of depth with anyone about his time in Chile. And as you might imagine by looking at him, he was quite a unique individual. And he stood out even among his cybernetic contemporaries. So just so that we're all on the same page, cybernetics, as defined by the MIT mathematician Norbert Wiener, is the study of control and communication in the animal and the machine. It brought together ideas from a number of disciplines, including electronics, computation, neurophysiology, et cetera, and mapped them onto the behavior of mechanical, biological, and social systems. And you can definitely see the range of disciplines that appear in Beer's work. He definitely moves from the mechanical to the computational to the social to the biological. I devote one chapter of my manuscript to tracing Beer's biography and his early writings prior to 1971 when he arrived in Chile. And I'm going to share with you briefly some of the highlights of his cybernetic ideas, although my apologies to the late Stafford Beer because it won't even come close to acknowledging the nuance that is in his writings. So very briefly, Stafford Beer was interested in the study of exceedingly complex systems. So these are systems that cannot be specified in exact detail. So the brain is an exceedingly complex system. The economy is an exceedingly complex system. And moreover, he abhorred reductionism. So he didn't want to break an exceedingly complex system into every single one of its teeny tiny component parts and find every single relationship. He thought things should be studied holistically or systemically. He disliked the way that computers were being used by businesses and government organizations. So think, you know, 1960s, early 1970s, we're talking about mainframes. And computers were being used as gigantic data processing machines. You had your data going in, the giant brain calculating it, and then you had your data going out. That probably was compiled into a large report, you know, that sat on somebody's desk, and who knows whatever became of it. He thought that this didn't recognize the potential that computers had. He thought that computers should be tools for decision making, and they should be tools for action. So he was always looking for ways to use these computers in a different way. And finally, in a cybernetic vein, he was interested in using his cybernetics to implement a form of control over these exceedingly complex systems. But when we think of control, a lot of times we think of control as something that's authoritarian or oppressive, and that wasn't his idea at all. In fact, he said, if you think about control in this respect, you know, how control normally works, it's nothing more than a crude process of coercion. And indeed, if we think of someone trying to control an exceedingly complex system, there's always room for subversion. You know, there's always room for the unexpected result. So instead of trying to keep the exceedingly complex system at a series of fixed values, you know, this iron-fisted sort of control, he wanted to keep a series of the most important components within a range of values. And he wanted to connect those components so that changes in one of the values could be absorbed and adapted by the others. And in this way, he thought that he could create a form of control that was adaptive and was similar to a biological organism that was struggling to survive in its ever-changing environment. This is one of the central ideas in Beer's cybernetics. It's called the viable system model. And it's too complex to go into great detail, but I'm going to share with you the basic idea so that you understand. The viable system model, Beer felt, belonged in all systems that could survive, that were viable. It could exist in biological organisms, in organizations, or in things like the economy or the firm. He believed that the viable system model was recursive, so that if you had a nation that survived that was viable, within that you could have a government organization that had the same series of relationships, within that you could have a worker that had the same series of relationships, and the cell would have the same series of relationships. So when he was designing management systems, they could also have this recursive nested feature. And perhaps most importantly, the viable system model presented a form of decentralized control. And perhaps the best way that I can explain that is through the biological example. So if we look at what I've labeled as system one, sensory, you see a number of biological organs. So you see the nerves, you see the heart, you see the lungs, you see the muscles. And normally you don't think about the operation of each of these components. If you had to think about your heart beating all the time, you couldn't think of much else. So looking at the lungs, normally you don't think of your breathing. It's something that happens automatically. But if you're in an extreme situation, your brain can intervene from above, in the case of the lungs, and control the rate of your respiration. So if you're swimming, for example, it's an extreme situation, you can breathe only when you need to. So I know if any of you are, you know, doctors or biologists, it doesn't work exactly that way, but that's the idea that Stafford Beer had. And in my work, I draw a parallel between this idea of decentralized control in the viable system model and the idea of democratic socialism in the Allende government, which sought to preserve individual freedoms within this overarching framework of guided socialist change. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you how the system worked. Beer arrived for the first time in November of 1971, and by March of 1972, he and a small group of Chilean engineers had come up with the name Project Cybersyn, which was a synthesis of cybernetics and synergy, the whole is more than the sum of its parts. And they had also started to translate Beer's cybernetic ideas onto the functioning of this technological system. And they came up with four subcomponents: a telex network, a software suite, an economic simulator, and an operations room. And this design not only reflected Beer's cybernetic principles, but also Chile's technological limitations of the day. So just think about this for a second. Chile was trying to design a computer network when they only had access to one computer. Just think about that. So ARPANET was being designed at the same exact time, which had the multiple mainframes that were connected. What Chile decided to do is they only had the one computer, so they built a network of telex machines, telex or teletype machines, that would be placed in the nationalized factories. They would be connected to a centralized command center. The data would roll in, human operators would take it, they would punch it onto the punch cards, feed it into the computer would have results, and then it could go right back out on the telex network. So in essence, this is how the system worked. The factories would generate 5 to 7 indices of production data per day. Remember, it's only identifying the key components of the system. They would be transferred to the control, the communication center via the telex network, where it would be processed by the mainframe computer. If the production data looked okay, it would be thrown away. If it looked like something bad was going on, a message would be sent back to the factory manager, and the factory manager would have a limited amount of time to address the problem on his own. So in this way, it preserved factory autonomy, this idea of decentralized control. If something was wrong and the factory manager couldn't resolve it, a signal would travel to higher CORFO management, where theoretically, once the room was built, they would sit in the operations room and they could intervene from above in the factory behavior, and in this way keep the entire economy as a viable system. Okay, so in my remaining time, I'm going to talk about several of the themes that appear in this book and give you an example so that you understand how it is that I read the system. And the first example is using technology to read history. So there are a lot of ways that you can enter into the historical process and understand what happened in the past. My particular way, my particular lens, is to read technological systems. So here's an example. This is an image of the operations room chair that I showed you in the beginning. And then also I put a reproduction of the original design sketch for that keypad interface. And I have most of the original design sketches from the system, which is pretty cool. So the buttons on the armrest is how you would control what was displayed on those panels that were on the walls of the operations room. And it's pretty interesting because if you think about what an interface typically is to that type of system, what is it normally? I mean, what do you normally have to control what's on the walls or what's on your screen? Yeah, it's typically a keyboard, exactly. And the designers got together and they started thinking about, well, who's going to be sitting in the operations room? Who's going to be making these decisions? And they decided it was either going to be members of the government elite or semi-educated workers, because they wanted to do reproductions of the room in the individual factories. Neither group had skills as typists, because typing was traditionally a secretarial role, a gendered role. So rather explicitly, you can find in the documents a conversation to eliminate the girl between the user and the machine, and to bring the user closer to the working of this machine. And so I think that's really interesting that you can look at a technology like that and see, well, who's going to be making decisions? How is a worker being defined? You know, a worker isn't necessarily a clerical worker. And from a history of technology perspective, that's pretty interesting, because normally when we think of the routinization of labor, you know, a lot of times when work becomes feminized, it becomes routinized or de-skilled. But in this case, it's the exact skills that are being read out of the space for decision making. Okay. Here's another slide of the operations room. And it looks like this very sleek, modern space. Perhaps those are even flat panel display screens from the 1970s. But if you look at the floor plan right next to it, You can see that there are a series of slide projectors behind the wall. You see that? Those three slide projectors right there? And the slide projectors were attached through wires that ran under the floor and ran up through the base of the individual chairs. So when you hit a button, and literally these buttons were designed as big hand buttons, so when you wanted to make a point, you could pound them. So when you hit a button, it would advance the slide carousel and change the image. So it looks like something, you know, that's, you know, automated modernity. You know, you can control the economy with, you know, simply by pushing a button. But really, there's a lot of work holding this illusion together. Every single one of those slides was drawn by hand by Chile's top visual and graphic designers. So it was just a tremendous amount of human labor to create this illusion of a socialist modernity that you could control by one button. And in my work, I compare that to the idea of an empanada, I'm sorry, a revolution with empanadas and red wine. You know, this idea of a transformation without costs, but that really, it takes a lot to make anything happen. Okay. Another theme in my work is I look at this technological system as a canvas for the way that people projected their own hopes and fears about the Chilean revolution. So one example of this is a folk song that was written by Ángel Parra. And Ángel Parra is one of Chile's, he's a very famous Chilean folk singer, and he's the son of Violeta Parra, who is perhaps one of the most beloved folk singers in Latin America. And Ángel Parra got to know Stafford Beer in 1972, and he decided to write a folk song about this technological system. And it was called Litany for a Computer and a Baby About to Be Born. And you can see the chorus to the song right at the bottom. Let us stop those who do not want the people to win this fight. Let us bring together all of science before running out of patience. So the rest of the lyrics talk about how science and technology could help end corruption, how it could raise the standard of living for the Chilean people, and of course in the chorus, how it could be co-opted to help the people win their fight for socialist transformation. In Berlin last year, I was able to present this work along with several of the participants, and we invited Ángel Parra to come and sing his folk song. So that's a picture of him right there. And it was the first time that he had sung it in public in over 30 years. And so I have a recording of it, and if there's any interest at the end, I can play some of it for you. Another way to look at how this technological system became a canvas is through press accounts. So this is an image from the British publication Science for People. And instead of the system being, you know, a form of decentralized control, you see this very heavy-handed, centralized model of what type of socialism and what type of technological system this would be. So here you see the Chilean boss, you know, with one finger touching the computer, which, you know, sets in motion a series of cogs that controls the Chilean worker who is now a robot. Here's some from the Chilean press. Here's a headline: Secret Plan Cyberstride, Popular Unity Controls Us by Computer. And another one from the magazine Arcilla. It says, Mr. Beer's Big Brother. So the system is being read as akin to George Orwell's 1984. The final theme that I'm going to present is cybernetic socialism, which is, you know, big in the manuscript because it is the title. So one of the things I look at is how Allende's articulation of socialism and also concepts from Marx's writings also appear in discussions among this group of engineers and scientists, and how it gets mapped onto this technological system. So worker participation was important for Allende, and there were many discussions among the project team about how this system could augment worker participation. So one idea was that the workers would work with operations research scientists to help build the models of the factories, you know, because who would know the factory better than the worker themselves? I see this particular drawing, which you might recognize as a version of Beer's five-tier viable system model. I see it as a response to Marx's idea of alienation. So in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, Marx talks about how the worker in an increasingly industrial society becomes dehumanized and increasingly becomes part of the machinery. They're not using their head anymore like the craftsmen that came before them. They're only using their hands in a very mechanical manner. So here the worker has been inserted into Beer's five-tier viable system model, And you can see that the worker is at level one, they're using their hands, but they're also inserted into level five, meaning that they're part of the cerebral cortex, they're part of the actual management system. And there's a lot to say about worker participation that might be interesting to this crowd, so feel free to ask me. Okay, so work on this project stopped when the military coup of September 11th, 1973 took place and ushered in dictatorship under Augusto Pinochet. I spend one chapter of this manuscript tracing what happened to the system and what happened to the project participants, the men and women that were involved in its construction. And I speculate that components of the system were used by the Pinochet dictatorship in ways that Stafford Beer and his Chilean colleagues would not have imagined. Okay, so I'm going to conclude with a few words about the significance of this research. So first, this is a story of innovation, creativity, and interdisciplinary collaboration. And when I interviewed a number of the project participants, they said that Stafford Beer's commitment to building interdisciplinary project teams for this technological system was one of the most lasting and enduring facets of this project that they continued to use for the rest of their careers. On a more macro level, this project illustrates the flip side to a vein of economic thought, which is, you know, neoliberal economics is good for innovation because it opens up markets, it fosters competition, and drives innovation. Here we see an instance of the US-led economic blockade leading Chile to engage in a number of activities of improvisation, many would say improvisation, but I argue innovation, and you see it in computation as well as in a number of other areas. This story raises issues that are still relevant today, such as how computers can be used for governance, the balance between freedom and control, and how to build a participatory technology. And I'm really interested in this idea of participation, and I think my next project is going to play with that some more. The last two points might seem like academic points, you know, perhaps even esoteric points, but I'm going to conclude by arguing that these are important points. So the first one is that this story provides a new take or a new perspective on the history of computing and the history of technology. And if we think about what we know about the history of computing, it is largely a US-centered narrative. Let me just think of it for a minute. There are some experiences from Britain, from Western Europe, perhaps some from Japan, but for the most part, it is predominantly a US-centered narrative. And this story illustrates that other areas of the world, you know, even areas of the so-called developing world, do have rich and valuable experiences with computational technology that are worth studying. And this is a rather, let's say it's an explicit aspect of my work. So in 2005, I built a multi-part installation that was part of the exhibit Making Things Public, curated by Bruno Latour and Peter Weibel at the ZKM Center for Digital Art and Media. And you can see the operations room and a virtual reproduction of the operations room on the side of the screen. And it was to educate a broader international public about this history of computing that took place in Chile. Okay. The last point is that this story provides an alternative reading of the Allende period. And that's really saying a lot because a lot's been written on the Allende period. It's one of the most studied periods in Chilean history and perhaps one of the most studied periods in Latin American history. And when I arrived in Chile for the first time in 2001 to start studying this history, I was surprised that hardly anyone knew about this apart from the participants themselves. The last article I found that had been published in Chile appeared in the mid-1980s. In 2003, a journalist for the Chilean publication The Clinic found out about my work and conducted an interview and published it as part of a series of commemorative events commemorating the 30-year anniversary of the death of Allende. And this is what the front page of the article looked like. And the story resonated with a number of Chileans, particularly young Chileans, particularly those who are involved with science, technology, and computation. Because just think about it. I visited the History of Science and Technology Museum in Santiago, and they had a display on the history of computing, and everything was from the United States, you know, perhaps England. There was nothing that had to do with Chile. So a few years later, two young media artists approached me and they wanted to do an exhibit on this history. And the result was an installation that is currently in the Presidential Palace in Chile, in La Moneda, and this is what it looks like. And I had a chance to visit it when I was there a few months ago, and I saw school children going in with notebooks, and I imagined perhaps it was for, you know, some class project, which, you know, I like that. So I'm going to conclude by showing this last image that I think speaks to this alternative reading of Chilean history that I'm talking about. And this was taken from the site of a blogger who posted on Atina Chile, which is a web portal for all things technological in Chile. And it's a play on words. So one of Allende's famous speeches, he was saying that the revolution will open the wide avenues. And so here we see that Allende is saying, with banda, with internet, the wide avenues will open. And it's a play on words because banda ancha is wideband, you know, so wideband internet. But it's also referring to this alternative reading of Chile's short-lived political experiment with socialism, one that is grounded in a history of national technological prowess and innovation. So here is the outline of the book manuscript. I'm currently working on chapter 6, so I would love to hear comments and questions. Thank you.
More about you referred to the contested character of this project, and I wondered if you could say a little bit more about that. Was it contested at the time in the popular media, or was it only subsequently, or what was its status?
So the press accounts that I showed you were all from 1973, mm-hmm. The last year that Allende was in power. And actually, I have a cover of a popular magazine, and it's on the front page. You know, it says Secret Plan, Cyberstride. So it did appear in the Chilean media, the rightist Chilean media. Most of these publications were either rightist or right-leaning, being very critical of the system. Other than that, it didn't appear much. The people involved with it didn't really talk about it until 1973. And for that reason, it was often believed to have been a secret project, although it seems like there are differing accounts of that. Some people said, well, you wouldn't share it unless you knew it was going to work. Mm. You know, so if it's in its early prototype stage, why would you, you know, go talking to the international press? So prior to 1973, you don't see it so much.
Just a small aside, I was astonished by one of your slides, mm-hmm. which is the one from the magazine Science for People, uh-huh. which is a radical socialist magazine. Uh-huh. Why on earth were they seeing the whole thing as a Big Brother thing? I mean, I'm just astonished.
Yeah,
It's a very peculiar interpretation.
It is a very peculiar interpretation, and I think it shows the different readings of the Allende mm-hmm. government and what was taking place during that time period. There was also a personal issue. So the person who published that had originally contacted Stafford Beer about possibly working on the project, and it seemed like there was some falling out, and that was part of the result.
Also, the fact that Allende wanted to take a different path than, say, Castro towards socialism, so it seemed to me that you may have a split in the socialist camp mm-hmm. that would, you know, level criticism. I suppose. Fast forward to current state of socialism in the world and countries that have adopted their own unique brand of socialism. Think about it. Mm-hmm. And there's this evolution of what is good social practice, socialism practice. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that we were quite keen on Allende in Britain amongst the British left was quite keen on Allende, and they weren't that keen on Castro.
That's so, yes, right.
It's a good point. I mean, they were anti-Castro, and certainly weren't anti-Allende.
Right, right.
But at the same time, when you go through the press accounts, I mean, it's clear that the press is reading this government in Britain in very mixed ways. So one of the things that Stafford Beer tries to do is he reads the British publications, and he's saying, no, I've been down there, and that's not what's going on. You know, the shortages aren't because, you know, there's no food. The shortages are because, you know, people have higher living standards, and for the first time, you know, they can actually afford the food, and that's why. So, and he starts writing to the editor saying, look, you don't understand what's going on. And then there are instances that he has cataloged of Allende saying one thing and the British press interpreting it, you know, a completely opposite way. So it seems like there were just a lot of different conflicting readings of what was going on during that time period. Would you agree?
I do. Still great about what the Chilean experience was. Just one question. How much did the president know? if you allow me, I met him several times. And he, well, of course, he was an MD. He was scientifically minded, but this was just the front line of scientific
development. Can you speak up just a little bit?
He was an MD. He was a scientifically minded man, but also a politician. Mm-hmm. 30 years as senator. Did he know what was going on with this project?
Seriously, he did. One of the most told anecdotes of this system is the meeting between Beer and Allende that took place in November of 1971. And Beer outlined his cybernetic ideas, he outlined the viable system model, and he got to level 5, and he was ready to say, you know, and this is the space that I've reserved for you, compañero presidente. And Allende reportedly said, ah, at last the people. You know, so this was one of the most told and retold anecdotes. When I interviewed Stafford Beer, he said that Allende asked him, so I haven't had an international management consultant before. How does this work? And Beer said, well, you know, in my opinion, it's best if I don't have to bug you all the time. So if I can say that I represent you and that I speak for you, I can go and get things done and people will listen to me. And reportedly Allende said, ah, I like that very much. So Beer did a lot on his own. And truthfully, compared to what Corfo was doing, because Corfo was so big, this project was very marginal. So it didn't always blip at the top of the president's list. Yeah.
I'm interested in your approach to participation. Within the network, because I think in what we're seeing now, especially in media practices, media generation, which is the field I work in, different levels of participation from, you could call it remix culture with user-generated content to participation. What I'm specifically working on is how digital media leads to activism. Especially in the mobile technology sphere, and so it's a word that's loaded a lot, I think, because of some participation happens completely in the digital realm, some participation then transfers to people's lives. It seems like it's such a loaded term, and I'm just wondering how you're working on unpacking it in your work.
In the 1970s, I think it was probably a loaded term in a different way. It wasn't as much, you know, online participation versus, you know, real life participation. Yeah. Participation surfaces a lot. So one of the ways, as I mentioned, was that the factory workers would contribute to building the models. I interviewed several of the people who were actually going into the factories to make the models. And in reality, although there was this process of socialist revolution going on, class distinctions die hard. So if you take a university-trained engineer and they're supposed to ask the advice of a blue-collar worker, it didn't always work out the way that people theorized as the ideal. And there are reports of the workers being treated with an air of condescension, you know, as the white-collar operations research engineers went on and modeled the factory. So I also see that as a limit of the Chilean Revolution in terms of, you know, how well it addressed class or how well class could be changed. There's another aspect of participation that I didn't have time to address, but that you might find interesting. Beer had this idea of having the Chilean people participate and use technology to have them participate. So he theorized if he could put meters in the Chilean homes and, you know, then they could watch political speeches and they could turn a knob, you know, that said happy, or unhappy. And this would be completely real time and transparent to everybody. So not just the other people watching the broadcast, but also the president could see, oh, the people didn't like that, or, you know, they really like that.
It's like an American Idol.
Well, I was thinking more recently, like what CNN did during the election, because in fact, I was fascinated with this idea, and I was going to work with one of my colleagues to try to build these and do experiments, and then I saw CNN during the election, and what happened to that, and I said, well, maybe I'll wait. But the difference was that with Beer's model, everything would be transparent. So the president could see how people were reacting and theoretically could adjust on the fly. So I'm sure I'm out of time.
Yeah, please thank me, help me, join me in thanking. I'd like to.